From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, full exoneration for two men who said all along they were not responsible for the assassination of civil rights leader Malcolm X.
The FBI and the NYPD, if they had disclosed this information, could have clarified for the public. That would have changed the course of history.
A former NFL star makes it his mission to help kids struggling with profound loss.
COVID has exacerbated the issue of childhood bereavement, not only in the United States, but around the world.
And as families gather around the table once again for Thanksgiving this year, we'll answer that most pressing question.
What if you miscalculate the turkey cooking time and it's just not done and everybody is ready to eat?
All ahead on Perspective. Right as we went to air with this show, the news broke that Kyle Rittenhouse had been found not guilty. The 18-year-old acquitted on all charges in the Kenosha, Wisconsin shooting death of two protesters and the wounding of a third following the police-involved shooting of an unarmed black man in the summer of 2020. ABC's Jim Ryan was outside the courthouse when the verdict was read.
Yes, people are talking about it. Some are shouting about it. One man holding a sign up there that says, "Free Kyle," standing on top of the railing down the front steps of the courthouse. But everyone is sort of frozen in place, it seems, kind of taking it in, discussing it with each other, discussing it with reporters, and I think just realizing now that after 3.5 days of testimony that, in fact, this case has come to an end.
And ABC News chief legal analyst Dan Abrams says,
if you're a juror on this case, and you've looked at the videos, and you say to yourself, you know, I don't really think that this is self-defense, but it's close, that's a not guilty verdict. You have to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the prosecution has proven that case such that self-defense simply is no longer on the table.
In the past few weeks, the country has been riveted by that case and by another one, the killing of Ahmaud Arbery in coastal Georgia in February of last year. We've got more on that case coming up, but first, there was legal action in a much older case involving race and guns, and this one happened in New York City. This week, almost 57 years after the shooting of civil rights leader Malcolm X, two men convicted of aiding the assassin had their convictions thrown out. The guilt had been doubted for decades, and only recently did their lawyers make headway in convincing prosecutors the men had been convicted in error. ABC's Aaron Katursky has more from New York, where Malcolm X was killed on February 21st. 1965.
They don't attack me because I'm a Muslim. They attack me because I'm black. They attack all of us for the same reason. All of us catch hell from the same enemy.
Malcolm X, celebrated and reviled as a black nationalist leader, had broken with the Nation of Islam by February 21st, 1965, and was about to speak to a gathering of a new organization he founded at the Audubon Ballroom in Washington Heights.
I am at the Audubon Ballroom. Pandemonium is the only word that I can use to describe the scene here.
Gene Simpson, on a day off from his job as a reporter for WMCA Radio, attended the speech.
I heard a rumbling behind me, and I'm sure everyone else did too, and I turned around in my seat to see what it was. And then we saw, I saw two guys standing up, and the next thing, my next impression, it all happened very rapidly, as you can understand, is of the gunshots.
Three men were convicted of the assassination.
Calling number one on the tap A calendar, indictment number 871 of 1965.
A judge in Manhattan this week said two of those convictions were in error.
The court finds that an earnest reinvestigation has uncovered significant evidence.
The new evidence included a witness who backed up the alibi of Muhammad Aziz. Now 83, he and Khalil Islam, who died in 2009, spent 20 years in prison for a murder they did not commit.
I apologize for what were serious, unacceptable violations of law and the public trust. I apologize on behalf of our nation's law enforcement for this decades-long injustice.
Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance re-examined the case over the last 2 years and determined Aziz and Islam did not receive a fair trial because evidence that could have helped prove their innocence had been withheld and certain information had been suppressed.
Most critically, we have obtained dozens and dozens of reports from the FBI and the NYPD's Bureau of Special Services and Investigations. These records include FBI reports of witnesses who failed to identify Mr. Islam and who implicated other subjects and suspects. And significantly, we now have reports revealing that on orders from Director J. Edgar Hoover himself, the FBI ordered multiple witnesses not to tell police or prosecutors that they were, in fact, FBI informants.
There's no doubt at all that this was the right decision for the DA to make at this point in time, but it's just as clear that this should have happened a long time ago.
David Shanus is Aziz's attorney.
The experience of being prosecuted and accused of committing such a horrific crime, knowing the entire time that you're innocent, can only be described as horrible, terrifying. To then be convicted, which he never expected he would be because he knew he was innocent, was surreal. It was horrific.
Shanus and Barry Scheck at the Innocence Project championed the case and convinced the DA to review and ultimately rewrite the history of the murder of Malcolm X.
It changed the history of this country that he was assassinated. And if it had been corrected in the sense that we would have known exactly who did it and why, which the FBI and the NYPD, if they had disclosed this information, could have clarified for the public, right? That would have changed the course of history.
More than a dozen FBI and NYPD reports were never disclosed to the defense, including eyewitness descriptions of the gunman that did not match either Islam or Aziz.
The event that brought us to court today should never have occurred. Those events were and are the result of a process that was corrupt to its core, one that was all too familiar to black people in 2021.
Aziz, in a gray tunic and white mask, addressed the court on the day of his exoneration.
I'm an 83-year-old man who was victimized by the criminal justice system. I do not know how many more years of creative activity I have. However, I hope the same system that was responsible for this travesty of justice also takes responsibility for the immeasurable harm caused to me during the last 55 or 56 years. Thank you, Your Honor.
Moments later, the judge made it official.
This court's mandate requires that the judgments of conviction be vacated and that the indictment against Mr. Aziz and Mr. Islam be dismissed. The joint motion is hereby granted. And the record...
As applause broke out in the courtroom, Aziz appeared to nod gently and accept a congratulatory pat on the shoulder from his lawyer. He left court innocent in the eyes of the law. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Aaron Katursky, ABC News, New York.
The defense is now rested in the trial over the killing of Ahmaud Arbery in Brunswick, Georgia. Three white men are accused of shooting the 25-year-old, an unarmed black man, who was out for a jog in February of 2020. Race has played a key role throughout the entire investigation and trial, and this week it came up again. A lawyer for one of the defendants asked for a mistrial over the presence of the Reverend Jesse Jackson and other black pastors in the courtroom. That motion was denied. Let's bring in ABC's Steve Osunsami. He has covered these types of cases going all the way back to the 1999 dragging death of James Byrd Jr. in Jasper, Texas. Steve is there in Brunswick, Georgia. So what, Steve, has stood out to you in this trial since you've been covering it? Has there been anything that has really been, you know, that you weren't expecting or that really struck you?
The thing that struck me, and it strikes me about the Rittenhouse trial as well, is this presumption that we seem to have in America, that when a white man tells you, a black man, to stop, that the expectation is that you should stop. You know, Travis McMichael said over and over and over, you know, I just wanted to ask him a few questions. We just wanted to, you know, figure out what was going on, you know, as he has standing with a gun, pointing a gun at this man. And now that, you know, when, you know, and you, we've heard the same argument in this trial and in the other trial, he was running at me. He was going to hurt me. He was going to grab my gun. I had to stand my ground with my gun because I didn't want him to take it from me and shoot me with my own gun. That becomes the justification for this killing. That stands out to me. I've heard, you know, there's just so many cases where, you know, that argument is used. And this is getting a little personal, but I have a very modern family. And, you know, you're on Zoom, so you can see this, and this is radio, but this is my daughter.
The glare is, oh, she's beautiful.
Yeah, this is my daughter. And yeah,
she's also white.
She is white, right. And we have like I said, we're a multiracial family, gay, all that stuff. I know that if she were the one who refused to stop Travis Michael, never said a word to him, if she were the one who grabbed his gun because he, you know, who tried to push her way away from him, I know that none of us would be here right now if it were her, because there wouldn't have been a presumption that he was right for stopping her and that she should have stopped because he told her to. There is a certain set of presumptions that I see in this trial that really hit me, in that there were other people, we heard testimony, there were other people who were at that same construction site who did not raise the level of suspicions that this young Black man did. The first one of these type of stories that I have done for ABC News was in 1999. It was the dragging death of James Byrd Jr.
In Texas,
Jasper, Texas. There were three white defendants who were accused of killing that man. All three were sentenced, and one of them, at least one of them, was killed. Some of the same arguments that are being made in this case, I heard back then some 25 years ago.
You brought up the Kyle Rittenhouse case. Yeah. And the Kyle Rittenhouse case happened in the midst of a protest against a police shooting of a Black man who was unarmed in Kenosha, Wisconsin. This case is different, but do you feel a difference now than you did in the James Byrd case 21 years ago, 22 years ago?
There is a difference. The conversation that's happening in this country over the issue of race is a lot louder than it was then. The diversity of the media that is sharing these stories is different now than it was then. When I first started, we only had, I want to say, four Black correspondents on the air, four Black television correspondents on the air at the time. Today, at least twice that, if not three times as many, and behind the camera. And in government. So yeah, things are different, but that's also what makes it so surprising that we're still having mm-hmm. these same conversations and still dealing with these same issues. And it's interesting because in both cases, both shooters took the witness stand, which most defense attorneys will tell you that's suicide. But not in this case. They were able to humanize themselves to jurors. And in both cases, we're talking about almost entirely white juries.
And at both times you have police standing by waiting for the verdict.
Yeah. I mean, it's gotten to the point where we've done so many, and I've personally done so many, I have trouble keeping them straight.
You have covered these types of stories, as you mentioned, for so long. Do you yourself ever say, I don't want to cover this?
I don't. I think, you know, everyone has a different opinion on that. I don't at all. One of the things, you know, you have to be fair no matter how you feel. But I'm able to sometimes say things in a way that helps people understand it a little better, especially when it's a situation where it's a lived experience.
ABC Steve Osunsami covering the trial in Brunswick, Georgia, of three white men accused of shooting and killing 25-year-old Black unarmed jogger Ahmaud Arbery. Thank you, Steve.
Yes, it was good to talk with you.
When the 1619 Project from the New York Times came out in August of 2019, it generated intense discussion across the country. The project, created by Nicole Hannah-Jones, whose opening essay earned her a Pulitzer Prize for commentary, was first published in the Times magazine. It placed slavery and its continuing legacy at the center of our national narrative. Some applauded it, some soundly denounced it. At the time, Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton proposed a bill that would ban funding for teaching the subject and the teaching of critical race theory, an academic concept that suggests racism is embedded into the legal systems and policies that have shaped our nation. The 1619 Project, a new origin story, is now out in book form. It was released this week, and I talked about it with the woman who started it all, journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones. What does it feel like to be the person in the center of a cultural firestorm, a discussion? Some people call it outrage. Some people call it awakening. What does it feel like to be in the middle of all that?
It's surreal, and I'll say it really depends on the day. Every journalist gets into this profession because you hope you can do work that is important and that has the potential to be transformative. And I certainly could not have expected when I first pitched this project that it would become what it has become. But there's also something, you know, really difficult about becoming a symbol to people. I didn't get into journalism thinking anyone would ever really know my name or care about me as a person. I got into journalism because I wanted people to care about the work.
One of the things that is happened since this came out is somehow this project morphed into critical race theory. You know, where did we even get that?
Yeah, so I'm going to push back a little bit on that framing. It didn't somehow become under this umbrella of critical race theory. We have to understand this critical race theory hysteria as an orchestrated propaganda campaign by conservatives who I think were responding to the racial reckoning that we saw last year, that were responding to millions of Americans really trying to grapple with the idea that slavery's long shadow continues to shape our society and that there's structural inequality that Black Americans face. And so we see this campaign that was part of a political campaign to really try to stoke white resentment and to say, they're coming for your history. They want to strip down the monument to all of these great white people, and they want your children to feel bad.
Why do you think it angers so many Americans when you state the things that have been stated in so many of these essays? Why does it make so many people, white people, angry when you talk about these things?
Well, because I think we are indoctrinated into the belief in American exceptionalism. And that idea of exceptionalism is predicated on our founding as divine, as our founders as demigods, and believing that if we talk about slavery and the role of slavery, that somehow discredits the American enterprise. I don't think that's true. I think that we can be honest about our history and still feel pride in our country, but we have to be honest. So people don't want, I mean, everyone knows that slavery existed in the United States, but most of us don't know how expansive it was. We don't understand the duration, the brutality, how foundational it was to the society that would be built, and that's intentional. So people, I think, you know, in the opening essay for the book, I talk about when I took this one semester African-American studies class in high school and how that changed my life because I had believed all this time that Black people hadn't really done much that we should learn about. And I think most Americans think if this were true, surely somebody would have told me these things before. And so when they read all of these new facts that they've never heard of, the reaction is disbelief, because I think many of us can't believe that slavery would have played such an important role, and yet we had never been taught that. And some people respond to that by saying, oh my God, what else haven't I learned? And others respond to that by saying, this has to be fake, or someone would have taught us and I don't want to know this. And I think we're battling those two things. But my experience with this project has been that most people come to it with an open mind and are actually, even though it's very uncomfortable history, have gratitude that they are getting a better understanding, because 1776 and that narrative doesn't explain how George Floyd gets murdered on national television by a white police officer who knew he was being filmed and didn't care. It doesn't explain the insurrection on the Capitol. It doesn't explain so much of the tensions and the polarizations and the inequality that we have today. But if you understand 1619, your world starts to make sense. And I think you then also know that we don't have to be chained to our past, but we have to understand it if we want to build the country that we believe that we are.
Excellently said. I still remember the first day that I was in grade school and found out about slavery. Two things I remember finding out about slavery, and I just being like, it going home and saying, can this be true? And looking up the World Book Encyclopedia and looking up all the things and just being shocked. And the other one was the Berlin Wall. And I was like, what? They did what? They put a wall up? And when you find out those things, you're exactly right. That you're thinking, wait a minute, hold on. If I didn't know this, what else didn't
That's
I know?
Right.
And it's still being taught. The whole idea of the Dunning School and states' rights in the Civil War is infuriating.
Yes. Yes. And Teaching Tolerance has surveyed high school students. And fewer than 10% of high school students know that the primary cause of the Civil War was slavery. So when we have this whole propaganda campaign that says, you know, our kids are being taught to feel guilty about slavery and our kids are being taught inaccurate history. The truth is, our children have been being taught an inaccurate history. It is a history that really tries to cover up the role of slavery.
The 1619, A New Origin Story, it's in book form. It came out this week. Nicole Hannah-Jones, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Coming up, a shift is coming to the cars we buy. We're at the Los Angeles Auto Show with the electric future of vehicles on Perspective after this.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective, a closer look at the week's top stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, helping children grieve. We'll tell you about One Foundation's honorable mission, but first. The ongoing global chip shortages have led General Motors and Tesla to announce some big changes this week. GM says it'll have to remove heated seats as a standard option on many of its new models. Tesla has told customers there may be 16 months wait for some new models. So what's in store for other car makers? ABC's Alex Stone takes a look at the Los Angeles Auto Show.
It's a different auto show this year, Sherry, the first during the pandemic on one of two media preview days. Listen to how quiet the show floor was. Almost empty, very few people looking around. Normally, automotive reporters and analysts from all over the globe have flown in to see what's coming in the industry. It would be loud, people would be packed in, music would be blaring. This year, the crowd is smaller, but the reveals are still happening here.
It's time for electric to turn into lightning. An electric truck that can match the ambitions of this nation.
Among the many announcements, Ford showing off its new fully electric F-150 pickup, the F-150 Lightning.
F-150 Lightning has the comfort and capability you need to go to the campsite, the job site, or wherever your day takes you.
Electric vehicles are the big deal here this year. Every year it seems like the LA Auto Show has a sort of unofficial theme, what all the big players are doing. Some years it's been technology in the vehicles. Some years it's a switch from, say, sedans to SUVs. One year was all about hybrids coming out. This year it's about making everything electric. I sat down with Auto Trader's Brian Moody.
I mean, there's clearly a trend toward electric cars, and some of the concepts that we're seeing are cool looking. One of the great things about electric cars is that it allows automakers to reimagine the spacing, the floor planning, let's just say, of how a car is built. It doesn't have to look the same. it can look different because there doesn't have to be a big engine up front.
The cars and trucks that are available right now are not all equal to the gas-powered counterparts, and the price tags aren't there yet. The electric versions are off the charts expensive in many cases, but Moody believes the big story out of this year's auto show here is that Ford F-150, which, by the way, without a combustion engine, the pickup has a trunk in the hood. You lift up the hood of the pickup, no engine, it's trunk space.
I think in terms of just the show overall, it's the Ford F-150 Lightning. I think it's a big deal culturally, I think it's a big deal automotive-wise, and I think it's a big deal for consumers.
Because now you're talking about an electric vehicle that is not a Tesla or a tiny sedan. It's a product that speaks to the heart of America, made by a strong, tough American brand. Over at Chevrolet, most of what they're showing off here is still powered by gasoline. They say they are working on more battery-powered options, but for now it's about hauling capacity and speed.
The newest products, and sort of like the highlight for Chevrolet, is of course the new Corvette Z06. It's completely new. It takes the popular C8 that we introduced in 2020, and it's the high-performance variant. So we have that on display, and then the new Silverado ZR2. Pickup truck is on display, and that is our flagship off-road truck.
But it comes at a time when if you drive by a dealership, most don't have many or any vehicles to sell across all brands. Because of the microchip shortage, dealers have nothing to sell. Chad Bulch with Chevrolet says they promise soon you will be able to buy what you want.
There has been an issue with the supply chain in terms of semiconductors and chips, and we are seeing an increase. There are more chips available. And in fact, we have turned on all of our North American plants to full production capacity, and we expect volume to increase in 22 compared to 21 significantly. And especially in Q4 of this year, production is already up.
But between the pandemic and now this unique time of factories unable to produce vehicles because they don't have the chips or other parts they need, Brian Moody believes how we're going to buy cars from now on will be different, not just a bunch of random colors and options parked outside at a dealership. And during this time, because of supply and demand, prices for new cars have gone sky high above the MSRP, no more dealing, way low.
Right now, the hard reality is people are paying full sticker price and more to get the car they want. In fact, at Auto Trader, like we even asked people, we polled people, and they said that they would be willing to pay up to 13% more to get the car they want. Okay,
wow.
So that says to me these people obviously have the money to spend. Okay, that's okay, but that's not the whole market. And I think the unfortunate part of that is it's hard to walk that back. Once people are used to paying full sticker price, how do you then go in and say, okay, I don't want to do that? What's going to have to happen for that to happen is demand has to go down and supply has to go up. I think we will, toward the middle or end of 2022, see increasing supply. And, you know, as the market cools off, the prices should reflect that.
And how we buy?
That's another change to the business that people are going to have to be okay with. If dealers aren't going to stock up all the cars they think that you might want to buy on their lot, you're going to have to be okay with pre-ordering and waiting a couple of months. Now, some people do want to do that. Other people, they just want the best deal and they want to buy a car that day. And if that's you, just be flexible and, you know, ask them what they have.
Reporting for Perspective, I'm Alex Stone, ABC News at the LA Auto Show.
November is Child Grief Awareness Month. The 18th was Child Grief Awareness Day. Childhood bereavement, a critical issue before the pandemic, but COVID has exacerbated it. ABC News producer Leighton Schneider spoke with Brian Greasy, an analyst for ESPN's Monday Night Football and the co-founder of Judy's House, which helps grieving children and families in Denver, Colorado, find connection and healing.
This is an issue that hits close to home for Brian Greasy and his family.
Judy was my mom. She died when I was 12 years old from breast cancer. She was a nurse by trade and was the most compassionate and caring person that I've ever known in my life.
He remembered thinking he was alone when he lost his mom at the age of 12. He was angry at society for not curing cancer and God for taking someone who did so many good things.
Most dangerous, I was angry at myself for not being a better son when I had the opportunity to not doing more for my mom and not having a chance to go back and fix any of that.
All of that led to the creation of Judy's House and its research arm, the JAG Institute, in 2002. The foundation provides a safe place for children and families to find connections with others and works to build coping skills for kids and their caregivers.
Those coping skills are centered around feeling the grief, addressing the grief, and not stuffing it or alienating it, but passing through it, feeling it, and then learning how to build skills to deal with it.
Childhood bereavement was a serious issue before the pandemic, but has become even more critical now. According to the journal Pediatrics, it's a hidden and secondary tragedy, with over 140,000 kids losing a parent or caregiver to the virus between April 1st, 2020 and June 30th, 2021.
COVID has exacerbated the issue of childhood bereavement.
Minority children bore the brunt of the deaths, with one out of every 168 American Indian and Alaska Native, one out of every 310 Black, and one out of every 412 Hispanic children losing a primary or secondary caregiver, compared to one in 753 white children. One thing the Institute tries to do is share data with others around the country on what is best done to help and what the risks are of not helping grieving kids.
We believe that childhood bereavement is a critical public health issue, and that getting ahead of it and helping kids develop healthy coping skills is a key to addressing the issue and helping these kids long-term.
Greasy says society has a need to try to fix or say something to a child that is grieving, but that likely isn't what's needed.
So something as simple, Leighton, as saying, I'm sorry. Well, when you say I'm sorry to a child, that feels good to you, right? It feels good that you're saying I'm sorry to a kid, but to that kid, you've made it about you and not about them. In reality, we need to create a safe space for that child to open up, to begin to have a conversation or to process.
The key to that is a relationship.
Think to yourself when you're in that moment, how can I make this person feel the most comfortable? And how can I let them know that if they want to talk about this, when they want to talk about this, on their terms, I'll be here for them.
He adds the end goal should be to create that safe space.
If we all have that mindset, then I think we'll do a lot better job of companioning and connecting with grieving individuals.
Reporting for Perspective, I'm Leighton Schneider, ABC News.
It feels like we've celebrated a lot of tech anniversaries lately. 2020 marked 10 years of Instagram. Google bought YouTube 15 years ago. If you're a gamer, though, this month is a big one. ABC News tech producer Mike Dubusky explains.
It was 20 years ago this month that then-Microsoft CEO Bill Gates pulled the wraps off the first Xbox.
For the first time, let me now unveil Xbox.
On the outside, it was a black plastic square, about the size of a shoebox, complete with a big X stretched across the top and a lime green Xbox logo. As for the inside, I'm going to let Dwayne The Rock Johnson explain, who was also there.
The Xbox is everything The Rock is, cutting edge, powerful, exhilarating.
The device has been through four generations, each of which have added a myriad of features and garnered huge followings. But in those early days, none of that was a sure thing.
The company took a huge risk.
That's Danny Pena, host of the long-running gaming podcast Gamertag Radio.
They were not 100% sure if the console was going to be successful or not in the early days of Xbox.
One of the keys to the excitement around the Xbox when it first came out was down to a feature that a lot of people take for granted now, an Ethernet port. That one little port allowed for Microsoft a year later to launch Xbox Live. The service allowed gamers to play with their friends online. That's not a totally new concept, but that Ethernet port allowed gameplay to happen over high-speed internet at a time when many systems still used slower dial-up connections. Here's IGN executive editor Ryan McCaffrey.
With broadband gaming, you could just have a better quality game experience. And it really changed everything.
The road to the Xbox's 20th anniversary has had its fair share of potholes. Many generations of the Xbox were prone to significant hardware problems. In fact, according to a 2009 study, nearly a quarter of all Xbox 360s experienced some form of system failure. That's four times the rate of its contemporary competitor, the PlayStation 3. Reliability problems were so pervasive that Microsoft actually issued a recall that, according to Business Insider, cost them more than $1 billion. Whether it's Forza or Halo or one of the many other Xbox games, something that has changed since 2001 is the relevancy of physical video games.
Microsoft is already forging into cloud-based gaming. You can play a number of Xbox games streamed right to your phone.
Recent Xbox consoles, like the current Series S and a version of the higher-end Series X, don't even feature disk drives, and that could give us a hint into the future of the console.
Xbox could just be a streaming app through your television. And if you just have a controller and connect that to your TV and the whole thing streams, I don't know. It's really interesting to see how this industry is going to evolve and how Xbox is going to evolve over the next 20 years.
Reporting for Perspective, I'm Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
The pandemic kept most Thanksgiving festivals on the small side last year, but this year, with more of us vaccinated, a lot of people are inviting a lot of family to the table. When it comes to affording it, the USDA says a big turkey only costs about a dollar more this year than last year, but the cost of other staples is up 5% from 2020. For some, it's not about the price tag that's stressing them out, though. It's cooking all that food for everybody. ABC's Daria Albinger has some tips from a pro on getting it all done.
Okay, so last year I cooked Thanksgiving dinner for just two people, my husband and me. And while it may have been one of the easiest holiday meals I've ever made, it left me unusually stressed out. You know, we have this 8-foot-long dining table and we love to fill it up. And we're really looking forward to doing that this year, except now I'm worried about cooking a big dinner after being out of practice for all those months.
We kind of had a reset last year. And we hated it. So let's celebrate the fact that we're actually entertaining people and we can have people to our houses. But I think the key to making this easy and keeping you sane is to do as much prep in advance.
Connecticut chef Brian Averna.
So you can do things like make a stuffing in advance. Don't bake it, but make it and freeze it. Wrap it in a foil, put it in a foil pan. So that's done. And then the day before Thanksgiving, you thaw it and, you know, on Thanksgiving morning, you bake it.
And Brian says the make ahead thing also applies to the pie. Make the crust, fill it and freeze it, and then bake it the day before Thanksgiving or even the morning of if you have the oven space. But he says under no circumstances do you cook the bird ahead of time. So that begs the question, fresh or frozen?
Well, most fresh turkeys have been frozen at one point or the next. I happen to have a friend of mine, and he actually is growing a turkey for me this year. So for the first time, I know I'm getting a really prime, fresh turkey. It doesn't really matter because almost all of them have been frozen at one point. I don't know that there's a huge difference. If you do buy a frozen bird, make sure you thaw it properly in the refrigerator for, you know, maybe 3 or 4 days. Takes a while for that bird to thaw out, and you want to keep it safe. There's all sorts of bacteria in that turkey, and you want to make sure that you either you kill it in the cook cycle or that you don't allow the bacteria to grow while you're thawing it.
You know, just a question. A lot of people say, I want to thaw this turkey. I don't have room in my fridge to thaw it.
No, so you can thaw a turkey in in a big sink filled with cool water, and you have to keep that water running. So yeah, you have to put some paper towels in the stop, in the drain, so you'll have a little bit of water going through. You'll always have fresh water movement, and you can thaw a bird out, and that will take several hours. So if you absolutely, but once you do that, Daria, you're going to have to put it in the refrigerator anyway.
So sides and dessert ahead of time, and focus on the bird on the big day. But what if something goes wrong?
You burn one of the side dishes. You burn the stuffing.
Add more chicken stock. Scrape off the burnt part. Cover it in foil. Make sure it's nice and warm. And that's a good way to recover on that.
What if you miscalculate the turkey cooking time and it's just not done and everybody is ready to eat?
Okay, that's a great question. Remove it from the bone. So you're separating the breast. You're separating the legs and the wings. Put it on a cookie sheet, cover it in foil for the first half an hour or so. If you really had to, you could pre-slice the breast, cover it with some wet paper towel, maybe drenched in some chicken stock, cover that in foil and bake it at a very low temperature. And so, but boy, if you use a thermometer, there's no way you could undercook a turkey breast.
And he said, if you have to toss a side dish, you toss it. You're going to have a lot of food anyways, along with plenty of family and friends that you probably haven't seen in a long time. And that is really something to be thankful for. Reporting for Perspective, Daria Albinger, ABC News.
From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. The show was produced by Leighton Schneider. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.